Hello, I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, bringing you a Floydcast number 11 for April 28, 2014. All right, well, starting up the Floydcast with some big news. Dallas, Texas, is going to end 50 years of water fluoridation, and they voted that way on Friday, April 25th, 2014. And in the heading, they tuck in the words, "This whole subject of fluoridation is so full of deception. It's truly sleazy. It doesn't take much to find it." Had to let the cat in. You know, cats are just, and they go through cycles of where they sleep. And our cat, his cycle currently, he wants to sleep in my lap. And he'll be like that for a week. He will do everything, including, you know, putting his claws on you and kind of like, "Hey, I'm here." He's here right now. I had to pause the Floydcast because I wanted him to be outside, but he kept meowing so heavily, I thought, oh, great, it'll probably show up on the soundtrack. So I'm going to try and stall him. We'll see how that works. Or maybe I'll just pick him up. Hang on. All right, just picked him up. He's purring away. I guess you get a... This is the purr cast. I don't know if you can hear it. I'll try and move away. I'll move away from the microphone a little bit. All right. So, yeah, Dallas, Texas.
School book depository and all that.
Other conspiratorial stuff. Anyway, the headline says, Dallas ends five decades of water fluoridation, saves 1 million a year. So, of course, that's going to be the angle, right? Dallas City Council members decided to end the fluoridation of the city's water supply. It was made after months of regular visits by citizens to city council meetings warning about the risk involved with water fluoridation. On Wednesday, ardent anti-fluoridation advocates were surprised when months of regular visits to the council meetings had another result than usual. After five decades, they'll be stopping the practice that has been implemented to counter tooth decay, a practice that since has shown to be inefficient and to cause more harm than good. Now, really, did it take 50 years to figure out that it's, number one, inefficient, and number two, causes more harm than good? Did it really take 50 years? You know, when you are up against the biggest powers there are, then it takes 50 years. This has nothing to do with information. It has nothing to do with regular people. I hope that shadow, well, he's settling a bit here, because he's been purring and moving around, and you probably picked up some of that. But this has nothing to do with regular people. And I'll get into that more in a bit. Okay, economic factors rather than public health concerns may or may not have played the primary role. Well, they can't even get to it, right? Why? Well, these council members are saving their skin. You know, they know where the power is. The power is with fluoridation. So, you know, they're bowing to, you know, local pressure. That's the way, right? When you want to get something big pushed through, you cave in when there's a sufficient local pressure, but you just keep the overall project going. I don't think that this particular action is going to have profound, earth-shattering consequences, although I have to say, I believe this is one of the biggest cities to stop fluoridation. So this is a gradual trend that they are allowing, let's be honest. And it's like the tobacco thing. Condoning tobacco didn't stop overnight. It was a gradual process that they allowed so that their lawyers could have the class action lawsuits and make the big money. And so then they just split up Philip Morris, right, the tobacco company, and it still exists. All the, you know, different parts of Philip Morris exist. Even the company exists, you know, supposedly now to educate on tobacco. Well, when was the last time you were educated by Philip Morris on the harm of tobacco? You know, it's token. Fluoridation opponents reportedly claimed that the city could save about $1 million a year that is spent on the industrial chemical. "We don't need it. We'll save $1 million. This person was backed by a few others. And then there was an anti-fluoridation activist who said, this is major big. I knew we would prevail. It only makes sense." She's more concerned about the possible health impact, of course. They said toothpaste is a better way to fight tooth decay. Well, you know, of course it is. This has nothing to do with tooth decay. Because frankly, even toothpaste probably has immeasurably small results, if any. And definite bad results from toothpaste, from fluoridation, from pills. It's all bad. This isn't a partial good, partial bad thing. It's like sugar. Sugar is partially good and partially bad. You need some sugar. Now, you don't have to consume it. Your body can make it. If you eat bread, you know, the body can break up that complex carbohydrate into simple carbohydrates, but you do need some sugar, right? We have glucose rolling around our bloodstream. We need some glucose. Okay. This isn't like that. Numerous studies have documented that fluoride reduces tooth decay if it is used topically. Well, that's just a whole questionable thing in itself. When? It's only when you're young. Well, fluoride does the most damage when you're young. Anyway. Studies have shown that one does not achieve adequate results by metabolizing fluoride in the digestive system after ingesting it. Well, that's a pretty powerful sentence there. It's true. And it puts the whole lie to fluoridation right there. Just read it again. Studies have also shown that one does not achieve adequate results by metabolizing fluoride in the digestive system after ingesting it. In other words, when you drink fluoride, you don't get results or good results. So why do it? To the contrary, the latest research suggests, this is from the article, suggests that fluoride is linked to a number of neurological risk factors. And a bunch of people weigh in. They state that industrial chemicals injure the brain, linked to ADHD, dyslexia, and autism. And these guys, they had previously identified 5 industrial chemicals. Now, listen to the chemicals they list: lead, methylmercury, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, arsenic, and toluene. Since 2006, they claim. So only in the last 8 years. Epidemiological studies have documented 6 additional developmental neurotoxicants. These 6 are manganese, fluoride, dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, tetrachloroethylene. Now, tetrachloroethylene is like carbon tetrachloride, it's like a dry cleaning, the fluid they use in dry cleaning, and polybrominated diphenyl ethers. Well, the only one of those that matters that they recently identified is fluoride. So now they've done enough studies that they just can't hide it. Basically, that's what it amounts to. It took a certain number of pounds of studies, apparently. Probably in the tons. And after tons of studies, they now can't hide it. And then they conclude with, these guys postulate that there are even more neurotoxicants which remain undiscovered and propose a global prevention strategy to control what they describe as the pandemic of developmental neurotoxicity. Well, I think it's a good point. I have an article coming up which I call Toxic, and it's about toxic things. And so this kind of ties in well with that. So that's the big lead-in, is Dallas ends 5 decades of water fluoridation. That's about as big as the story gets in the fluoridation biz. You know, we'll hear some more of that, maybe only on, you know, specialized forums like Fluoride Poisoning List. We might hear a bit more about this. I'll keep you posted. That's big news. So, yay! Last week I talked about the name, the importance of the name, and I said how we're all different. I gave some examples, like with the David. And I gave another example with the combination which they call the accident looking for a place to happen. There's 81 possible combinations. There's 9 numbers, 2 positions. 9 times 9 is 81. There's 81 combinations, and there are 2 combinations that are that accident looking for a place to happen. One is a 527, and the other is a 775. They had sort of that magic pair of the 5 and the 7 together. Basically, the 5 can be that accident combination because, you know, they're impulsive and they're sort of chaotic and they're full of energy and they're always, you know, bouncing around. And then the 7 can be a problem because of the sensitivity of the 7. They tune into the wrong thing. The 5 is a hunchy quality, so it goes by its gut. And so that's also tuning into things. It's going by what it tunes into. And the 7 can't help it. It doesn't go by its gut. It's more... it's connected. 7's connected to the thoughts of others and things. And so that combination is like, it's like a whirlpool. 527 or 775, they're like a whirlpool. They can get drawn into stuff. Or put it another way, there are whirlpools of trouble in mind, in the mental world. And those name combinations will attract it and can get drawn into it. And I was telling you about my sister who has that combination and how she had a bizarre incident with getting off the school bus crossing the street. That's all she had to do, get off the school bus, cross the street. I did it 100 times, never had an incident. Now, admittedly, I was there for 1 school year, she was there for longer. Still, my brother did it too. he got off the school bus and crossed the street and nothing happened to him, my younger brother. But my sister had this bizarre incident where a car veered off and then hit a power pole, a very large pole, like as large as you can imagine a power pole, because it had an air raid siren on it, and it was just like sort of one of those master poles. Some poles are bigger than others, this one was bigger than others. It was gargantuan. I worked on the railway at the time. I climbed poles. This was a pole to admire. It was so big. But it was also a long way away from the road. It was like 30 feet, a good 30 feet away from the road. So not only did this car, when it veered off and left the road, not only did it managed to find this pole like that was so far away, and really, honestly, it's a one in a million what happened. That it hit that pole, that it hit it hard enough to knock it over. The wires from it, you know, became a problem to my sister. It was all one in a million stuff. Maybe one in 10 million. Well, something happened 2 days ago that I want to bring up because it's dramatic. It's in the news, and it's a big story, and it's a guy, it's the 775 again. Now, I want to point out that I understand that you're skeptical about the name, and so I have normally not talked about this subject. As I mentioned, it's the 800-pound gorilla in the room or on my website that I don't talk about. And it's because of the lack of receptivity of people in general. People come to part of my website called Super Baby Names to get baby names, and I have the largest collection in the world. It's about as large as the rest of the world combined. It used to be hosted on another site, and then they basically took it off. Even though I had sort of give it to them to display and give to the world, and they made it pay only. So I was like, okay, then I'll put it on my site for free, because I believe this is important, everyone should know. So at least I had started the subject with you last week, and I was saying how we're all different. If you calculate the probability of any two people being the same, it's infinitesimally small. There are a lot of numeric factors in your own name, how you sign your nicknames, how you initial, and then the same is true of your mom, the same is true of your dad. And then, frankly, if you have brothers that are a certain way, in other words, certain numbers, they're going to influence you by their numbers. In my case, I had two older brothers who were quite sort of mischievous troublemakers. Well, what do you think I was when I was a kid? I was exactly the same way. They'd be like, oh, you're a Maxwell. Now, I've actually changed my name, but we'll go with that. The teachers would say, oh, you're a Maxwell, are you? You know, and then it'd be like, well, let me go back in my memory. Ah, yes, here's the Maxwell clan. But we were proud of it. And it was harmless. Honestly, all of our tomfoolery when we were young was harmless. Most things today are much more harmful. Facebook is much more harmful to life than any mischievous kid. So, this story is about Donald Sterling, who is the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers. Now, Donald Sterling said, apparently, and it was recorded, said some things that, you know, it's allegedly him. It was a conversation, they know who one of the parties was, and that one party was Donald Sterling's girlfriend. And then the voice certainly, let's say, sounds like, you know, certainly could be Donald Sterling. They haven't, you know, locked that in yet, but I'm going to assume in this little podcast that it is him. It fits the profile, unfortunately, because apparently this Donald Sterling has said things in the past and done things in the past that have got people up in arms. And this latest one, you know, is sort of, now, you know, a lot of people think he's gone too far. And they're calling for him to not be in the league, to not be an owner. We're talking about a team that's worth like over $1 billion. So this is like a $1 billion problem all of a sudden, caused by one person. One person saying something and it getting recorded. You know, that's my definition of, you know, accident looking for a place to happen. A person that they are causing their own problem here. A different person with a different name would not do what this person appears to have done. So they said some remarks against a certain group of people. Racist remarks were said by someone who appears to be, might be, allegedly is, Donald Sterling. Well, let's look at the numbers now. Donald is 775. That's the accident looking for a place to happen. But there's one other 775 in this story. The Clippers. Each player on the team would say, I'm a Clipper. That's what they would associate with. That's the vibration they would be picking up. That's the apple they would be taking a bite from. Well, Clipper is 527. It's like my sister's combination. Another accident looking for a place to happen. So you have the members of the team that are accidents looking for a place to happen, and then you have the owner with the same combination. So now imagine your owner has said something that, well, appears to have said something that whoever said it, it's absolutely racist. And it's against the color of the majority of the team. So now you have to play. Now you're I'm a 527 and this guy's, somebody's majorly discriminating against me. Now I have to play basketball. Well, now you've created, like, that's why this got so big. Yeah, well, it's actually why it's going to get even bigger. It's bad enough what the initial person said, but now there's another big whirlpool that's going to get sucked into this, and it's all those players. And this is going to scar these players for a long time, quite frankly. Regardless of what happens to the owner. And by the way, I'm betting that he's going to get off. But the players are going to be scarred by this pretty substantially. Let's put it this way. If I was in trying out for a major sports team, I would definitely want to be considering the combination of the team. It's interesting, the Devil Rays got changed to just straight Rays. Well, that changes the team. This is not a baseball team. A team in Florida. Is it the Florida Devil Rays or Miami Devil Rays or Tampa Bay Devil Rays? It's one of those. It's something in Florida that's the Devil Rays. And now they're just the Rays. And of course, there's another team that's in the news for its name. And that's the Washington Redskins. Some groups have decided the name is racist, and now there's a lot of pressure being applied against the owner to change the name. I think the major argument is that, you know, it's right in the dictionary that it's a racial epithet. And so that's sort of like the major argument. I mean, the major counter-argument is it's been around for decades or longer, and basically most people, the vast majority, don't care. And also, thin edge of the wedge, you could start seeing the names of all kinds of sports teams change because of this, right? Because there are the Cleveland Indians and Kansas City Chiefs in football. But apparently, Chiefs and Indians, those are not negative terms, whereas Redskin is, according to the dictionary, perceived as a negative term. I don't like the political correctness angle. I don't like media pressure trying to change things, and there's lots of that in this world. And so I automatically am against all of that. So that's about the only angle I have on the Washington Redskins, is that just to fight the power, just to fight the media dominance, I would not change it. But what's probably going to happen in that one, I'm going to bet that it will change. And the reason is money. The owner wants to move, get another stadium. Stadiums are $1 billion a pop type thing. And it's pretty obvious that public money, which is the guy's going to go after, it's not going to be his money. Public money is going to be held up by this, well, you got to change your name of your team. So that's probably ultimately how that will resolve. So, 775 accident, bang, within a week of me talking about it. Now the point is this, is that these accidents, these disaster names, they come up all the time in the news. It's probably the most common one where you can point right to the story and go, accident looking for a place to happen name. Let's just crunch some numbers here. There's one chance in 40, two chances in 81. That you have an accident looking for a place to happen, first name. Well, there's one chance in 40 that you have an accident looking for a place to happen, last name. And there's one chance in 40 that you have an accident looking for a place to happen, total in your name. So already we're 1 in 14, roughly. And then let's say there's 4 members in your family, that's 4 in 14. Or, in other words, there are people around you that have this combination. But the point is that it's only 1/40th. Of all the combinations, and all kinds of combinations have all kinds of problems. This just happens to be sort of the leading edge, the most obvious target for me to point to and give you an example that over and over again you can see. So I'm going to try and bring other examples up in the future about it, and for now we'll just sort of leave that as a friendly I told you so. Here's an example 5 days later of a major accident that found a place to happen. Times two. now all those Clipper players are going to be sucked into this whirlpool, and without a doubt, they're going to be the worst scarred by this. Okay. All right, the third video that I wanted to talk about was I've been reading some books the last few days. I don't normally read books. I normally, you know, sort of have a purpose. I'm researching things. I don't usually, you know, retread old ground too much, but I do occasionally. And one of the common areas that I retread, especially in the book category, is nonfiction, and particularly the most exciting of the nonfiction. And for me, that's the Person Against Nature books. Those are the early explorers, people who, you know, pioneered new areas, whether it's space, whether it's Greenland, Arctic Adventure with Peter Freuchen, Arctic Adventure, unknown book, relatively unknown anyway. Well, I would say it's totally unknown. It's a 100-year-old book of his adventures 100-plus years ago, of being a trader, an official, I think, Danish trader in the northern part of Greenland. Imagine. Not just Greenland, which even the southern part is obviously, you know, ice-covered and cold. Imagine what the northern part is like. We're now well inside the Arctic Circle. In fact, Greenland doesn't touch the North Pole, but it's awfully close. Anyway, his adventures are just completely mind-boggling. Worth a read. Worth buying the book. Worth a read, to say the least. Arctic Adventure. Well, the books I was reading the last few days, similar vein, but they were climbing books, mountaineering books, as they call it. As a person who I was reading about Ed Visters, V-I-E-S-T-U-R-S. Ed Visters is one of the big, well-known names. As he points out, there are many types of mountain climbing or climbing. There's now bouldering and rock climbing, free climbing, weekend climbers. There's like every level. But arguably, the mountaineering is a combination of the most real, i.e. this peak has not been climbed before, try and get up it any way you can, you know, that sort of mission impossible, like getting to the moon. You know, getting to the moon was a real challenge. No one had done it before. You know, humans had got there before. And that was a real all-out challenge. You know, the stuff that's happened since then has been anticlimactic. It's like Hillary climbing Everest was the real challenge. And everything since then has been anticlimactic, even though there have been greater accomplishments far and away. I guess the youngest person that's climbed Everest is 13. The oldest is 80. People have skied and paraglided off Everest. These are all considered various records. You know, who was the first or what's the youngest age type thing. But still, Sir Edmund Hillary, you know, he's the man, right? And Tenzing Norgay, the Sherpa that climbed with them, they did it first. Well, another first category, major first category, is the goal to climb the tallest peaks. That's actually split into two parts. One goal was to climb the tallest peak on each continent. And that's a bit of a gimmick. And the gimmick is because, for example, in Africa, the tallest peak in Africa, Kilimanjaro, even though it's 20,000 feet, is kind of trivial to climb. It's something that, you know, masses of people do. I don't think anyone takes oxygen, for example. They just, you know, there's a big fat trail and you climb up type thing. So that dilutes that particular series of records, we'll call it, of, you know, climbing the tallest mountain on each continent. To me, it's very much gimmicky, although, obviously, Everest is one of those peaks, and Everest is non-trivial. An average of one person in six dies trying to climb Everest. Well, that used to be the formula. I think of late it's much, much less. It's about 1 in 30 now. For every 30 people now who try to climb Everest, one will pass away. The number has, it's become a lot safer. Hang on, Pete. But some of the mountains on some of the continents, the North America one, which is probably Mount McKinley, Denali. I think that's the biggest one in North America. That's, you know, tough but not impossible. And again, a lot of people have done it. The South American one, I don't remember the name of it. From what I remember, it was pretty tough. One of the really tough ones, sort of surprising, who knew, no one even has heard of it, tough ones, is the mountain Mont something or other on Antarctica. And it's, again, it might only be 10 or 20,000 feet. I don't remember the figure. I could look it up, but what's the point? It's not that it's so tall, but that the conditions are so harsh where you're climbing. There's so little support. You know, you have to pack stuff in, right? with some climbs, can sort of figuratively drive to the mountain and then climb it. You know, the Matterhorn type thing. You know, the Matterhorn's kind of like in the, having a mountain in the middle of downtown New York kind of thing. It's a very accessible mountain. There's a lot of famous pictures of it, which is to say a lot of people, you know, are obviously close enough to it to take a photo, just casual people. I'm thinking of a couple of puzzles I've done where the picture of the Matterhorn is there and you see a cable car going by or whatever. The Matterhorn is a very accessible mountain. This mountain in Antarctica is the opposite. You know, it's worth reading these books because just the logistics of getting to these mountains, the cost, the will and energy it takes, the number of people, the tons of supplies, permits, lining up the people you're going to climb with, these are massive, massive things. These are massive enterprises. And, of course, the people, it's not just, oh, we'll take Bob and Frank along. Bob and Frank, whoever they may be, have been thinking about climbing and dreaming about climbing for decades. They've been working their game for decades. In other words, it's not just a spur-of-the-moment thing. Hey, let's take a picture of the Matterhorn. Hey, let's climb Everest. It's your kid and you want to climb Everest. You read all the mountaineering books. You follow things. You climb locally. You get better. You know, you connect with some of these other people, and then one of them invites you on their expedition or you invite them on yours, and then it actually happens. So just the preamble, just getting to Everest figuratively, is an amazing thing. And in fact, I think it might be like 10,000. If you want to get to the base camp of Everest, not climb it, I think you have to spend 10,000. The Nepalese government will charge you 10,000 just for the right to try to climb to Everest base camp. And of course, people have, you know, died or gotten so ill just climbing to the base camp that they had to go home. Base camp is about 2.5 miles up, 17,000 feet up, leaving about another 12,000 feet to go. So at Everest, you have to climb 12,000 feet to go from base camp to the top. And so some have argued, well, some mountains, you know, you have to climb from lower down. And when you work out, you know, the distance involved, some other mountains are more of a challenge. Well, some mountains you have to climb a long way in to get to the mountain. The penultimate example of that is Annapurna. Annapurna is, I think, the sixth tallest, 26,500 feet, something like that, rings a bell. So it's 2,500 feet, half a mile less than Everest. And it's less than K2 and, you know, a few others. But in the early days of trying to climb Annapurna, you had to trek in 360 miles. That's walking. And that's not just you walking, it's the porters carrying your stuff. So you had porters, and then you had Sherpas to help you with the climb, and then you had the Sahibs, as they were called at that time. It was a very, you know, colonial, old school, racist kind of hierarchy, right? Class system. Imagine having to walk 360 miles just to get to a supremely difficult mountain, as it turns out. Annapurna is considered the deadliest mountain. On Annapurna, obviously 360 miles just to get there, you don't just get weekend hikers. Annapurna has proven to be the deadliest because 1 in 3 expert climbers trying to climb it have died. Some of the greats like Ed Visters, I think he took him 3 trips. Many of them, you know. The exception was the first people to actually climb it in 1950 was Herzog. And Herzog climbed it on his first attempt. It was truly an outstanding achievement. Herzog knew it, and it changed his whole life. So that's mountaineering, is supreme effort. Only the best of the best should apply. People die, and yet life-changing consequences for those who, well, who do it, even for those who fail, but especially for those who are the first, who, you know, the ones who get to the top. Like Ed Visters, you know, he has a sort of a mountaineering company where they help people mountaineer. So that's where he makes his living. He has sponsors. That's where he makes money, is from the sponsors, or they help pay for the expeditions. Well, anyway, getting back to the records. So one of the records is the tallest mountain on each continent. I read about a few people who went for that record. Part of it is you don't necessarily go for these records, but, you know, first you get Everest, and then you're like, well, what other big mountains are there? And then you're like, oh, let's take on that one. And before you know it, you're like, hey, I've climbed the tallest one on 3 continents, you know. So you're from North America, you've already climbed McKinley, Denali, and then you climb Everest, now that's 2 out of the 7, you only got 5 to go, right? And the one in Europe is truly not that hard. I don't remember the name, but it's not that hard. Funny thing with dogs and scratching, it's like, it can go on for a while. It's not a, you know, dogs are not precise in their cleaning process. So scratching is like continuation of the imprecise nature of a dog. It's like, I'm going to do this for a while unless something else happens. So I'm the something else. I'm trying to distract her. Right now I'm patting her. So the other major record, and this is the more legitimate one. Okay, there's the record of who's the first on Everest and who's the fastest and who's the youngest. But there's also who has climbed the world's tallest mountains. Now, obviously, that's defined by their height. But it turns out there's sort of like a neat little cutoff. It turns out there are 14 mountains that are 8,000 meters, a meter being roughly a yard or 3 feet. So it turns out there are 14 mountains that are roughly 25,000 feet or higher. And so quite a number of people have endeavored to climb the 14, 8,000 meter peaks. Well, Ed Visters is one of these people. What makes Ed Visters remarkable? Two things. One is that he's an American, the first American, I believe, to do it. And he was one of a much smaller group to do it, to climb all those major peaks without oxygen, without supplemental oxygen. It's worth pointing out that oxygen, the amount that these climbers breathe is a small amount. They're not on pure oxygen. They're not breathing it like you see an NFL player breathing it on the sidelines. It's very supplemental, and you have to carry it. It weighs something. You know, you have to manage it. You have to have a mask on. It has a cost, in other words. And for many of these climbers, they've just sort of made the decision. Some are purists. My favorite climber, my dad's favorite climber as well, was Reinhold Messner. Reinhold Messner is the giant of climbing. He's much bigger, in my mind, than Sir Edmund Hillary or any other five climbers you care to put together. Maybe that's not fair. Let's say he's just simply the best. And he's Ed Visters' boyhood hero. Reinhold Messner was the first to climb Everest without oxygen. People thought he was going to die. They thought he was going to lose his mind because of it. Him and his co-climber, I've forgotten the name, because Messner's had a few co-climbers. But they did it. And then they accused him of having little miniature oxygen bottles that he took little puffs from. So a couple of years later, he climbed Everest again, without oxygen, alone. Now, you know, you take your proof along, right? Like you take pictures where... The point is that when you climb alone, you cannot possibly take oxygen because you cannot possibly carry enough stuff. The guys who use oxygen, other people are carrying that oxygen for them. That's sort of the creepy thing about oxygen. Not only is it an assist, but other people carry your assist for you. And in that sense, right away, it cheapens the accomplishment. Absolutely. So Hillary climbed with oxygen. Cheapens it. The big American expedition, one of them for sure. Oxygen. And the modern tourists who climb Everest pay their $75,000. $65,000 is the permit cost from Nepal, and then $10,000 to the expedition company to basically ferry them, as they say, up Everest. They're for sure on oxygen. So Ed Visters is in the much smaller group that climb without oxygen. Anyway, so Reinhold Messner, the great Reinhold Messner, was the first to climb the 14 peaks without oxygen. I think the first to climb them as well. Ed Visters, I think, was the fifth when he did it. He might have been the fifth without oxygen, whatever it was. He was up there, let's say. You know, he wasn't in the running for first, but he's up there. But Ed Visters is interesting, I think, because he's very conservative. Basically, I would translate that or elaborate and explain that by saying, you know, Ed Visters doesn't want to die. Now you'd say, well, who does? Or you might say, you know, yeah, those mountaineers, they're all crazy, they all want to die. Well, they don't. But they're willing to take a risk to try and accomplish something. And Ed Visters, I think, is, you know, smarter in the risk-taking department. He takes less risks. He takes on the biggest challenges. He has climbed the 14 highest peaks in the world without oxygen. A truly gargantuan accomplishment that even if he wanted to do that, only a select few have the body, the experience, the will, the luck to do that, to do what he did. But he's done it in a very conservative way, and in the sense of always putting safety first. Ed Visser's motto is, climbing the mountain is optional. Getting back to the base camp is mandatory. Which is to say, when it comes to those moments, and they're inevitable moments on these very tall peaks where you have to take a risk, if he thinks the risk is life-threatening, he won't do it. And he hasn't done it. And so, I think he's gone on like 30 expeditions to 8,000 meter peaks, and he's climbed 14, so roughly half the time he doesn't get to the top. Sometimes they've turned into rescue efforts. There was a famous 1996 disaster season on Everest in 1996, and Ed Visser was filming with IMAX for the famous IMAX movie called Everest. And they had to stop their filming and change the filming to suddenly turn it into rescue, to rescue these legions of climbers that were all, you know, so many of them were amateurs, and they were stuck on the mountain. And I think Ed Visser himself specifically... Did he save David Brashears? He specifically rescued a person. And it's not the first time and not the only time that he did that. And in his books, I'm currently reading Ed Visser's, I'm almost finished, K2, Life and Death on the World's Most Dangerous Mountain. And he's written some other books. He's written it. The first book he wrote was about his conquering the 14 tallest peaks. And there was another one of his that, I read of his on Annapurna. What's interesting with the K2 book and the Annapurna book is he sort of anthologized. He kind of mixed historical climbs, historical individuals and historical accomplishments with the most recent or the most significant or the more modern accomplishments on these mountains. So they become like a history of climbing on the mountain. And again, Ed is, you know, very much interested in the safety and rescuing of people versus the recklessness and trying to get to the top at all costs approach. And so that's been interesting and worth reading for that. I guess as I've gotten older, now Ed Visser is the guy I read, you might say. When I was younger, it was Reinhold Messner. Because Reinhold Messner, like many climbers, is more driven by the, you know, get to the top at all costs. Now, Messner was never the type to cheat and to steal oxygen tanks from this guy. Or, you know, yes, there is some of that in this climbing business. Messner wasn't the type to have someone carry his oxygen bottles, because Messner never used oxygen. Messner was and is a great climber, and he's written over 50 books apparently, most in German unfortunately, but without a doubt, Messner took fantastical risks, I mean off the chart risks, and again and again. One of the things Messner did was he climbed across Antarctica unsupported, just set off and crossed Antarctica. Doesn't sound maybe like much, I don't know. There was a whole expedition, the Scott expedition, that they all died trying to go to the South Pole and come back. And Messner just did that sort of like, well, after you've climbed the 14,000 peaks, now what do you do kind of thing. So anyway, I've enjoyed reading these mountaineering books. It's something I do periodically. And I kind of wanted to talk about that a little bit too, the rereading or the rewatching, the rethinking. When you're in an age like we are today where everything is so disrupted, everything is, the current moment is more important than any other moment, right? This current tweet, this current text is more important than anything else. It's so important that I'm going to try and answer it and try and read it while I'm driving. And then you cause an accident and someone dies. But then we keep doing it, right? We keep texting and driving. There are literally millions of people doing this probably right now. Texting and driving. Cell phoning and driving. It's embarrassing. But it's completely unhealthy too. It's not like they are, you know, gold miners who are taking a risk and coming home with pots full of gold. There's no pot full of gold behind a text, behind a cell phone call. It's a predatory technology. Texting especially and cell phones in general are predatory technology. They're kind of like white bread or sugar or soda or something. Those are predatory technologies, or for that matter, cigarettes and alcohol. They prey on, they get you addicted to, and then they milk you without anything good coming out of it. Nothing good has ever come out of a cigarette. And I'm including all writers who smoke. Nothing good has come out of those writers. People that drink. Good things don't come out of the drinking process. Good things don't come out of texting or cell phones for that matter. So show some restraint, yeah, but no one listens, right? But anyway, reading these books and rereading the greats and rewatching the greats, that's what I like to do. It's my transplanting a tree approach. when you transplant a tree, you do something significant. When you read a great book, a great mountaineering book, a great true story, the rescue of Apollo 13 is fantastic. By the way, let's talk about the 13. You know, 13, bad luck, right? What is 13? 13 is 1 plus 3. What's 1 plus 3? 4. What is 4 by the Cavalarian system? The number 4 is the number of tests. If you have a house, the number of the house reduces to a 4, there will always be something wrong with your house. You'll always be fixing it. Well, that's what happened in Apollo 13. There was always something wrong, right? I mean, it wasn't just the initial explosion. There was also that they had to move to the smaller module, which wasn't designed for them. Then because it wasn't designed for them, they started to create too much carbon dioxide. They were going to kill themselves. Then they had to use the filters to try and... Like, there are filters to try and get rid of the carbon dioxide, to scrub it, as they call it. But the filters, they ran out, and then the ones from the main module, of which they had plenty, were a totally different size, so they had to haywire a solution to get the other filters to work, which solved that problem. Then they had navigation problems, where they had to sort of navigate by hand, literally looking at the Earth through the window and firing the rockets, and then, like, hold on, you know, and jiggling the joystick kind of thing, literally. Because you had to fire, you had to get the right speeds and the right, you know, fire at the right moments. But then they didn't have the computers, they were going off the grid. And so they had to do it intuitively, which they successfully did. And then they hadn't picked up the rocks from the moon. And the rocks was like a couple hundred pounds. And so that was factored into the original calculations. And it took a while to realize that that's why things were constantly a little bit off, was they didn't have the rocks. But they made it back, and it's truly a great accomplishment. But another interesting thing about Apollo 13, speaking of the 4 being the test number, and then there's a success number. The 8 is the success number. Well, the Apollo 13 two main modules, they had two names. One was Aquarius, and the other was Odyssey. Well, Odyssey was the command module, and Odyssey was the one that broke. What is Odyssey? 224. There's the 4 again. In fact, they say about the 224, it's not at all constructive. So that they had a completely bad name for the main module. Everything's going to break name for the main module, and that's exactly what happened. Then Aquarius, what's Aquarius? Aquarius is 898. If you had to choose the most successful, the most can-do, flat out the most successful, the best combination you could choose, you would choose the 898 out of the 81 combinations. And that's what the little lunar module was called. They went from the nothing but tests command module to the basically nothing but success. I mean, the word success is an 898. So Aquarius and success are identical mathematical combinations. So they went from nothing but trouble to nothing but success by switching from the command to the lunar modules. And so I always enjoy that part of that story. But that's an interesting story to follow and to read and to think about and to reread and to rewatch and to rethink about. And I'm really into that, rewatching, rethinking. And of course, the people who sell us products, they're not interested in us rewatching and reviewing and rereading. They don't want that. They want to keep selling us new products. Of course, the new being in quotes, that's new wine, old bottles, or, you know, it's really old wine, old bottles, but they give it a little bit of a burnish, a little bit of a polish, and they're like, it's new. You know, the sequels of movies, they're not new, right? They're just trying to cash in. And then the remakes. Anyway, there's lots of remakes these days. And it's the retreading and remaking. That's the dreadful side of Hollywood. People, you know, there's not too many innovators. There's not too many truly fantastic things in life. The most fantastic thing in life is if you can develop yourself. When you can develop yourself and extend yourself and rehabilitate yourself and re-educate yourself, take on something new and conquer, triumph yourself. That's the most incredible thing. But for many people, they're armchair quarterbacks, right? They just swill beer or smoke cigarettes or gossip about others and they don't accomplish. Well, those people need to be entertained, right? And that's the reason for the circuses, the Roman Colosseum and our modern circuses. Well, when you get to these mountaineering books, you really get right back to the most basic. You get back to man, the animal, man, the explorer, man, the survivor, man, the master of his will. You know, an animal does things by instinct. In other words, if you put the animal in the same situation 100 times, he would do largely the same thing every single time. Even the same animal, right? Year after year. Well, I mean, you know, animals will learn, and there are some animals that learn better than others, but they're going on a pre-program. Instinct is a pre-program. It's like when you turn your computer on, there's something called the BIOS. And the BIOS contains the beginning. And there's a bootloader in that. Then you start to load Windows and you see the little fancy logo, and then you get into your operating system. Well, that's a canned process. Your computer's not innovating. It has some degree of intelligence. In other words, if you forget to turn on a key part of your system, let's say you forget to plug your mouse in, your keyboard in, and try and turn on, it'll stop and it'll say, hey, there's no mouse, can't continue. But for the most part, it's canned, it's pre-programmed. And that's how, you know, animals are. But humans are not like that. We adapt, and 10 different humans with 10 different names have 10 different responses and approaches to something. And so when it comes to trying to climb a great mountain, a truly large mountain, difficult mountain, you need those different approaches. And then these guys, they write about their adventures, and then other guys scavenge the books and read about their adventures, their mistakes, what they learned in terms of routes, in terms of supplies, in terms of getting along with the other climbers, the weather. And gradually, you know, things were advanced and things went forward. You know, Everest was not conquerable, and Mallory famously died trying to climb Everest, and then Hillary made it. And then another guy makes it without oxygen. And then he makes it by himself without oxygen. And then you get a 13-year-old climbing Everest. You know, it went from the greatest could not do it, with expeditions, by the way, hundreds of people involved. And then you get Messner. I think Messner had one assistant who walked with him to basically the base of Everest, and then he was on his own. So he was two people. His expedition was two people, so he went from 1,000 to two. Anyway, with K2, it's kind of, I haven't talked too much about K2, I want to fit in a little bit about K2. K2 is the second highest mountain, as it happens. The two in the K2 doesn't reference that it's the second highest. It's the second highest of two unidentified peaks when they originally surveyed. Karakoram Range in Pakistan. The K stands for Karakoram. This was Karakoram 2. The photo shows a K1 and a K2. This was K2. K2 is almost as tall as Everest. It's, you know, truly up there. I think K2 and Everest are the only 9,000-meter peaks. So of the 14 tallest peaks that are taller than 8,000 meters, only two are taller than 9,000 meters. Well, that extra 1,000 meters, that's two-thirds of a mile. So K2 is two-thirds of a mile taller than the 14th tallest peak. K2's up there. K2 is very difficult because of how exposed you are in your climb. And yeah, you got altitude issues. I think K2 is technically a little bit challenging at times, but it's mostly the avalanche risk and where do you put your camps. Very hard to put your camps anywhere. Hang on. All right, I'm back. There's been a lot of comings and goings in the middle of this podcast. I started to kind of late, started at 6 a.m., and so a lot of people getting up and creatures moving around, going outside, and cats in and out. Times 10. Forget exactly where I was at. One thing I did quickly research while I was waiting for the dogs to settle was it's K2 that they originally had to walk 360 miles to get just to get to. And Annapurna is a bit of an isolated mountain, and it is quite a hike in. And when you get there, I think what makes Annapurna difficult is that it's very spread out, and yeah, avalanche risk. K2 is less spread out. K2 is one of those sort of more classic mountain shapes, a bit like the Matterhorn. Arguably, you could say K2 is the Matterhorn of 8,000-meter peaks. You know, it's just a big, fat object, and you have to climb that object. But I was talking about rewatching and rereading. I encourage this. I encourage you to find some truly good, truly awesome things in your life, and do those things. Do more of those things. Don't become a browser. Don't become a bee that flits from flower to flower all the time. You can do some of that. You know, we need to be current. There are some new things that come along occasionally. But honestly, most of it is not worth it. Most movies are definitely not worth it. Most books are not worth it. Most tweets are not worth following or reading. I have not chosen to follow tweets. I think the whole Twitter phenomenon is too short-term. I mean, a tweet basically is like a post, a random post on Facebook. I don't read random posts on Facebook. There are some amazing things there. And really, that's part of the problem. You'll get one person who finds an amazing, usually collections, right? People collect, you know, the greatest sunrises or you know, cutest cats or whatever it is. And they put it in a slideshow or in a video. And the point is that it kind of blows away the category. But there's no principles behind it. There's no lesson. There's no philosopher behind it. There's just, yeah, that's a great collection. In that sense, Facebook is like YouTube. Facebook is like a YouTube that the average person can contribute to. And, yeah, okay, I'm on YouTube, and you say, wait a minute, are you knocking something you're on yourself? I'm not knocking YouTube or Facebook in that sense. What concerns me is the dilution. It's like, let's go back to mountaineering. In the early days, it was Mission Impossible. Can you climb K2? Can you climb Everest? And now it's a 13-year-old climbs Everest. An 80-year-old climbs Everest. Facts. That actually has happened. Well, that's dilution. And then people get into gimmicks. One expedition launched onto Everest to clean up Everest, supposedly. Well, first of all, it's the nature of climbing at 8,000 meters that you leave a mess. And you leave a mess because you can barely get yourself out of there. And any weight that you were to carry that was excess, you're a fool to carry it. You're a fool. Even Ed Visters doesn't talk about proudly hauling out garbage from a mountain. He never talks about that. And the great climbers, the Messners and all that, they never think about that for one second. First of all, these mountains get so much snow that in a season, it's hard to see the remains of stuff. Now, yeah, there are more exposed areas. And in that sense, you can do a cleanup. There are some grisly things happen on these 8,000 meters. People die. And not only do they die, but sometimes they die just sitting there on the side of the trail. They just couldn't move another muscle. And you weren't able to help them. Either you came along too late, or even if you were there while they were still conscious, between you and them together, you didn't have enough energy to get them moving again. So they die on the side of the trail. And yeah, you can move that person to another spot, but sometimes they don't want to be moved. In other words, they're surviving family members, or, you know, it was their express will that just leave me on the mountain. You know, they're mountaineers, and they're quite happy, or they accept. If I die on the mountain, leave me on the mountain. One guy was rescued. It was a great effort to rescue one particular person that died on K2, I think it was. And one of the climbers who made it to the top, when he was 80 years old, was doing a Q&A after something, a movie or presentation. And this climber who had rescued one of the key people that had died on that expedition, you know, 50 years earlier, he said, hey, I just want to let you know I rescued that guy and I brought his remains back to his family. And the 80-year-old said, I wish you had just left him on the mountain. So while we move towards the gimmicks of 13-year-olds and 80-year-olds and cleaning up Everest, we're moving away from mountaineering. We're moving away from the accomplishment. And so try and keep in your mind, what is the accomplishment? What's great about it? What's great about it is how it makes us feel. A great accomplishment makes us feel great. And a little bit like, hey, I could do that too in some area. Like me, Floyd, saying, okay, I'm not a mountain climber. I don't have the knees for it. I don't have a lot of things for it. But I can do something in some area of life, something great. And I've done a couple of things I'm kind of proud of. And, you know, those things pay back. First of all, they motivate you to do it again. Second, they keep thinking about them going, yeah, I'm glad I created the International Anti-Fluoridation Database 25 years ago or whenever I created it, 20 years ago. I'm glad I did that. And now today, Dallas, Texas, is giving up fluoride. It might not last. It might be back. There might be a lawsuit. Who knows? It's all just a game to them. Also, they've got a bigger game now. They got the microwave game. And that's why there's a general trend the last couple of years, and it took me a while to figure it out. There was this general trend that the anti-fluoridationists were making gains. And I was trying to figure out, why is that happening? Why does it go 50 years with no gains and then it starts to happen? Why? Well, the answer is they've got a bigger game. Microwaves are way worse than fluoride, primarily because the dose can be 1,000 times worse. 100 times higher dose than normal of fluoride will kill you. So you can't increase the dose. The great thing about fluoride from the poisoner's point of view is that fluoride is insidious and it gradually creeps in and it gradually kills you. In that sense, it's like arsenic. You know, arsenic for many years was used by, you know, nasty people to slowly poison other people because it's an accumulative, a bioaccumulative poison, right? Well, fluoride is also exactly the same. People who control us, they always get a little smarter with each generation, right? And so with fluoride, they got smarter by saying, hey, let's make sure fluoride is everywhere in the environment so that then people can't point the finger at fluoride. In other words, you can't blame your utility for putting fluoride in the water because it's in toothpaste, because it's in the pills that kids take at school, because it's your dentist gives it to you, because it's in the foods. And that's smart. They guaranteed protection for themselves by doing that. In other words, we're all dosed with fluoride, and you can't blame one thing. With the cigarette, you could definitely blame one thing. So fluoride, by being everywhere in the environment, you can't blame the guy with the gun. It's a distributed bullet, number one. Number two, fluoride affects basically all aspects of us. So the great thing for the poisoners is that fluoride has a distributed effect. It can truly affect a wide range of systems. For example, one main thing it can affect is the dog's now eating food, crunching away on food. This flight guest has been a challenge. All because I slept in. And why did I sleep in? Well, getting microwaves out of my life, right? I'm sleeping way better. In the last 2 days, that would be 16 hours potentially of sleep. I've had 15 hours of sleep, so I've had almost the maximum. And I woke up a total of once in the middle of the night, across 2 days. I mean, prior to this, I would get, 4 or 5 hours sleep a night, and I would wake up 4 times. Can you imagine? I was waking up every hour. And for sure, I wasn't dreaming. I wasn't getting REM sleep. I wasn't rebuilding. Now, we're all just out. One person will get up in the middle of the night, and the other person doesn't even hear them even when they're in the same room. My wife and I, for example, have the kids. Oh, this is a nightmare. Everyone is waking up. There's eating. I haven't quite finished. I'm going to have to pause this again. Okay, back at it. Everyone woke up. A lot of distractions. A couple of things got to correct or get to. The news about Dallas and giving up fluoride, that was written by a blog. Even though the blog looked like it had NBC in it, I guess a blog hosted by something to do with NBC, it seems like they're going to talk about it. One of the Dallas council members is wanting to ditch it, it sounds like, but they're going to talk about it. They're going to get the engineer, Dallas city manager, Gonzalez, to investigate it. So it's not a done deal yet. All right, the other thing that I was getting to was talking about how fluoride, we've been making gains. Why are we making gains? And I finally figured out that the reason we're making gains is they've got something better than fluoride to take care of us, to do us all in, to get the population down to 500 million or whatever they're trying for. And that is the wireless. They can specify who gets the dose kind of thing. They can avoid it themselves through shielding. They can, of course, lie about it so that people don't know. And there's a lot of things going on, a lot of things in the news that all point to the same wireless trend. If you recall a few podcasts ago, floatcasts ago, I talked about the stupid idea of getting energy of solar energy on the moon and then microwave transmitting it to Earth. Completely stupid and, of course, completely hostile, destructive idea. Bad for humans. I just thought it was the stupid story of the day. I didn't think it was serious. Well, there's another one now. Japan is thinking of doing it, having solar collectors out in space and then transmitting them to Japan or to the Earth through microwave transmission. And now I'm wondering, now my theory with that is, I don't think these things are going to happen, but I think what they are is they are ways to introduce the... Well, two things. They're ways to introduce the public to microwaves and to accept it. They're a good thing. We get energy from them. We're getting energy from the sun through microwaves, and so we accept it. And then the other thing I think is they might do some of that, and just like the trend of trying to get blimps, balloons to carry wireless, and drones, planes to fly around giving us wireless... All of those things, what they have in common is it's a way to ensure that everybody is dosed so that nobody can point the finger and say, it was the cell phone towers that did it. It was my cell phone that did it. They could say, well, there's wireless everywhere. It's being transmitted from space, and so everyone's getting that. How can you say that? So they do have, let's call them serious bad reasons for these ludicrous notions of transmitting energy from space. It has nothing to do with actually getting something, gaining something, profiting. Not at all. This is financed. This is a loss leader. These stupid projects and the funding for them and everything to do with them is financed because it furthers their goal of cutting the population down. Okay, so I believe my thread was on rereading, the value of rereading, returning to things. I had a thought while I was puttering around here waiting to get back to my Floydcaster. If someone put the dilemma to me, the choice to me of which would you rather have? A steady flow of all the newest and greatest anything. Newest and greatest movies, newest and greatest books. You know, all freely shipped to your house. Or you could only access things that were, let's say, 10 years old and older. Which would you choose? And I would easily choose everything 10 years old and older. Easily. You know, getting back to the mountaineering. All the great stuff has already happened in mountaineering. It doesn't mean there won't be something great in the future. It just means there'd be a lot less of it and a lot more drama, a lot more negative stuff to do with mountaineering, a lot more political correctness. There was a publication, I think it might have been the New York Times, they were trying to interview him and trying to set Ed Visters up to say that there should be some rules in place so that certain bad things don't happen again. And Ed just thought about it and was like, no, that's just not how it works. You don't have rules about mountaineering. I mean, you could say there's a fundamental rule, you don't deliberately kill someone in order that you can climb on top of a mountain type thing, but it does happen indirectly, and you're not going to get rid of it by rules. That's what Ed realized. Anyway, the future is more rules in everything, and not a lot more innovation in anything, sadly. This culture we're in is at its zenith. It's like the Romans when they were at their zenith. This culture is at its zenith, and this culture is energy-fueled. We're at peak energy. We're at peak oil. We're at peak everything. And okay, there's going to be some more electrical, but electrical is nothing compared to oil in terms of how much we use, how much we need, how much we'll be able to practically get. It's going to be a downsizing future for our culture. Explorations are downsized, whether it's space explorations, mountain explorations. Scientific development is downsizing. Physics, it just shows it. It's just embarrassing. Really embarrassing. And as a friend of mine used to say, make thy heart small. He said that was, I don't know if it's true, but he said that was like a Chinese sort of a saying that they taught their children, make your heart small. I think the theory being that when you have 1.5 billion people in your country, you've got to breathe in perpetually. You've got to make yourself small to fit in. And there's some truth to that at any rate. Well, the world continues to get overpopulated. It continues to grow and madly, without wisdom, without a conscience, without shame. And so I choose the past over the future. It doesn't mean I'm not in the future. It doesn't mean I can't be current and contribute to the current world. But it's a mistake to be hooked on the latest movie, the latest book, the latest text, the latest phone call. You don't need to do that. I don't recommend doing that. Find basic principles. Live by basic principles. When you find basic principles, they won't change. You know, Ed Visters' motto of climbing to the top is optional and getting down is mandatory. He mentions that maybe 8 or 10 times in his book, and appropriately. He doesn't just, you know, flog it, or it's like he's only got one thought rolling around in his head. He's got lots of thoughts. But that is like one of his core thoughts, and it's a good principle. It's a good takeaway that I have from reading Ed Visters' books. Personally, I think he missed some of the positive side of some of the more crazy, more daring climbers. You know, I think he's jealous of the greatest climber, Reinhold Messner. You know, I think, just like with the rest of us, you know, we all look up to Messner and he was sort of our hero. And I think Visters, only met him once, had a bit of a bad interaction where he kind of, you know, approached him like a fan. Like approaching, you know, Tom Cruise or somebody, and, oh, Tom, will you sign my shirt, you know? And Reinhold Messner just kind of looked him in the eye and said something that Visters didn't like, but it was the truth at the moment, but Visters wasn't ready for it, didn't like it, and sort of burst the bubble. And I think Visters tries to make, you know, Messner the bad guy. Unnecessarily, it sort of cheapens Visters, and he's on the wrong track there. You know, Visters has had his own accomplishments and his own... He has something to offer himself, just like Messner does and did. There's room for more than one at the top. Well, I apologize for background noise. So I think I've covered most of what I wanted to this week. So I guess this week the distractions have dominated a little bit more than I'd like them to, but at the same time, that's part of living, isn't it? To conquer despite the distractions. I mean, you look at the K2 and some of the personality problems that they had and the challenges they had to face on all fronts. And the triumph. And the triumph is what you remembered 30 years later, in most cases. In some cases, the drama and the corruption was so bad that 50 years later, you're still thinking of that. But in most cases, it's the triumph that we remember. And so, here's to having a triumphant week. It's been Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast number 11 for March 28th, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.